I'm an alcoholic. My name is Sister Maurice, and I approve this message. How are you? That Hawaii tells you I come from a place called the Bronx. The Bronx is famous for the fact that the people born and brought up in the Bronx are the only people in the world who can say, I don't have an accent. And the other thing about the Bronx, there are only two places in the world that have the in front of them. One is the Bronx, and the other is the Vatican. And I'm associated with both of those places. I'd like to thank you for inviting me to come to this marvelous and wonderful spiritual event. I've had so many spiritual experiences here since I arrived on Thursday. It's nice to be invited. There was a time in my life when people stopped inviting me. I used to go anyway. And then I'd make a 30-day retreat wondering why they didn't invite me back. So to be invited today, it's very special to me. I'd like to thank each of you for coming to be with me on this, the most important day of my life. It's not my birthday. It's not the anniversary of anything in particular in my life. It's just simply the only day I have. And when people come to be with you at such a significant time in your life, like the only day you have, you try to remember them. At least I do. And I'll try to remember you because you're here with me on this, the most important day of my life. Whatever the past may be, the future is spotless. If I fail to be grateful, I may lose the gift. And I'd like to say thank you very, very much to David, who made the first phone call to me. And we talked about the possibility of my coming to this marvelous and wonderful event. And I've heard so many marvelous and wonderful things about David since I've been here. And he seems to be a very humble man. However, humility is truth. And when you pay a compliment to David, he says, no, 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 no. And David, all you have to do, there are two words to say, thank you. So I thank you, David, for inviting me and for your love and service. And when someone was sharing this morning about the situations you have had in the past few months, my prayer was, I know David's work is not finished. Thank you. I would also like to thank the chairpersons, Chris, for AA and Dick, for Al-Anon, for their wonderful service that we've experienced this weekend. I say thank you to Kathy and Kurt, who took care of planning the hosts and hostesses for the event. And I very much say thank you to the hostess with the mostest, Kathy W. and her beautiful husband, Les. And then there were so many that we sat with and met with, and I know their names are in the book here. And I say thank you to all of you. The bishop was going around to different churches, and he was just about to offer mass, and the custodian came up to him and said, "The mic isn't working. Could you wait for a few moments?" And he said, "Sure, no hurry." So after a few moments, they gave the bishop the signal that he could go up and begin the mass. And he got up to the microphone, and he knew the mic wasn't working. And he said, "There's something the matter with this mic." And the congregation responded, "And also with you." As I look out here this afternoon, I'm reminded of the preacher who was going to give his first sermon. And he was very nervous, and he got to the church a little bit early. And the bell was ringing, and he was supposed to get up into the pulpit and give his first sermon. And he came down, and there was just one farmer in the pew. And he said to the farmer, "What do you think? I'm supposed to give my first sermon, and you're the only one here." And the farmer said, "Well, if I had a load of hay and I went out to feed the cows and only one cow showed up, I'd feed the cow." And the preacher said, "You got it." Up into the pulpit he went. An hour and then some later he finished. And he came down and he said to the farmer, "What'd you think?" And the farmer said, "Well, if I went out to feed the cows and only one cow showed up, I don't think I'd give him the whole load." Now, if you didn't get that, you could talk to your sponsor. I stand in awe at this moment of God's love for me. I stand in awe of you and my relationship with you. And I stand in awe of Maurice. If you don't remember anything I share at this time, please remember this, because this is how I want to be remembered. It's the most important thing about me at any point on a clock. I'm an alcoholic, which means one brandy, two brandies, three brandies, floor. I'm a woman. I'm a member of a religious community. I'm an RN, a real nun. I'm I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous in good standing, in particular the Forest Hills group in Queens, New York. That's my home group. And the last thing I tell you about myself is my name. Incidentally, my name is Sister Maurice. One of the things that I'm partial to in our fellowship is that it's a fellowship of equals. There are no titles in Alcoholics Anonymous or Al-Anon. No one really cares what you do for a living. I love that expression, fellowship of equals. I don't think there's another outfit in society that can claim fellowship of equals like we can. At least we'd match any other group that's out there. And yet, you have never been anything else in this fellowship other than Sister Maurice. Isn't that a title? I see it as my name. It's on all my important papers. It's on my driver's license. It's the name I've been using most of my life. It's written up quite well, to Police Station, City of New York. But moreover, it's the name that I gave to you when I came into your beautiful presence a while back now. A call had been made for me, and I was to go to this Forest Hills group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I really wasn't quite sure that someone of my class and caliber should be going to such a place as AA. So I was not a happy camper when I came. But little by slowly, thanks to you, that has all changed for me. So much so that I can say quite comfortably today, I choose to live the AA way of life. For a few years, I said, I have to go to AA, got to go to AA, better go to AA. But you know what? I don't have to, got to, or better. I choose to live the AA way of life. And when I talk about something being a way of life, it's not an incidental experience. It's not something I do when the spirit moves me. A way of life to me is as much a part of me as my right hand and my left hand. And that's the way I see Alcoholics Anonymous today. But for starters, I went to this first meeting. I went up the stairs, down the stairs, into a little room. There was one man in the room. He took a look at me, came running across the room, grabbed my hand, told me who he was, and then he said, "What's your name?" I said, "Me?" He said, "Yeah, what's your name?" Oh, I said, "I'm Sister Maurice." Now, this man didn't say to me, "We'll have a group conscience meeting and I'll get back to you." The very next thing the man said was, "Hi, Sister Maurice. You're welcome." And in my over 35 years in the fellowship, no one has even suggested that I call myself anything else. The name is important. It's mine. But the most important thing about me at any point on a clock is what I told you first and foremost. I'm an alcoholic. And each and every time I say that, beginning first, when I awaken in the morning, I don't know how you sleep. Of course I don't. But I sleep primarily on my right side. And when I awaken in the morning, I don't even know I have two eyes, because this one's buried in the pillow. Before I go looking for this eye, the very first thing I do, I announce before my God, I am an alcoholic. It sets the tone here. It puts me on the right wavelength. And any time thereafter that I say I'm an alcoholic, I am reminded that of all the things I do each day that God gives me, my most important job, work, task, assignment is that I stay sober. And I do that best through the principles and traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous as they have been written. When I came a while back, you gave me a book and you called it Big. I thought it was an interesting way you described the book. The gal who gave it to me was much shorter than I was, and she stood out in front of me and she said, "Here is a big book." No coincidence, I'm very farsighted. And I saw some fellows over there putting some shiny signs on the wall. And my eye hit upon the one that said, keep it simple. And as sick and all as I was, I said to myself, wouldn't dare say it to the lady. I said to myself, boy, do these people practice what they preach. You can't get much simpler than that. Here is a big book. Of course, now we have the paperback, which I call the small big book. I don't call it the small book, and I don't call it the little book, because there's another book in the bookstore in the mall called the small book. And it talks about being an alternative to Alcoholics Anonymous. So I call ours the small, big book. Well, you introduce anything new in AA or Al-Anon, they send for you. And this fella came to me one night, and he had a small, big book, and he's pacing up and down. He's saying, hey, sister, you call this the small, big book. I said, I do. He said, that's a contradiction. I said, what do you mean contradiction? He said, small, big. I thought for a moment and I said, well, we have had jumbo shrimp for years. Well, I took the book from you, the one that you called big, and this is what you said to me. You told me I should read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I should study the big book. I should believe what I found there. I should share what I believe, and I should practice what I share. And then you said, we suggest you do that along with the people who know how to do it best. And you called that outfit the fellowship. And then you put the whole thing together and you said to me, that is a design for living that really works. What did I know about anything? I said, let me see what I can do. And that design for living has worked so well for this lady here that I don't spend a fleeting moment of my precious time looking around for alternative ways to go. I need all the help I can get, believe you me. But it is always as a secondary measure to the program. Alcohol became a way of life for me in a very short period of time. It dictated my moods, it made my decisions, it said you will, and it said you won't. I found it very hard to surrender to the fact that whenever the first drink, see, I thought maybe the 21st. But whenever the first drink of alcohol went into this body, mind, and spirit, two things happened. One, I didn't know how many more I was going to have. Two, I didn't know what the behavior would be like. However, if you met me along the way and you said, sister, how many drinks did you have or will you have? I would have said two, because that's what a lady should have. And if you said to me, and what was your behavior like or what will it be like, I would have said steady as you go, because that's how I saw myself. But I know today it was very different. I was a first grade teacher at the time, and I had the reputation in those days of being the best teacher in the school. When the children came to first grade after Labor Day each September, by the end of September, my kids were ready for college. So at 10 o'clock in the morning, I'd be working real hard with these kids, and something would start in my body, mind, and spirit. And it would be screaming in there, you need a drink. And the very next thing I would do, morning after morning, I would put up against the screaming what people told me I had so much of. And that was willpower. And the willpower approach was futile. And I went on to learn, and I'm glad I did, that it wasn't that I was a weak-willed individual, but rather I was a diseased person. I was a sick, untreated alcoholic. And when you are in that condition, it goes beyond the strength of your will to do other than to satisfy what's going on in there. So I'd move to the next phase of the game plan. And I'd say, well, it's a couple of minutes after 10. These kids can go out to the bathroom. Then they can have their snack. I'll get the teacher next door to keep an eye on them because I'm a responsible teacher. And then I'll run over to the convent and get a drink and be back when this is all over. Now, I'd be running across the yard to the convent morning after morning. And this would be my thought. This is going to be my last drink, at least until I've done my day's work. I was too sick to recall in those days that at 5 a.m., when the big bell went off to get us into our day, my story goes back to old God's time before we went mad. And we had this bell that went off at 5 a.m. And for me to get into anything in those days, I had to reach over from my bed and take that drink. And I hated doing that. And each and every time I did it, I would say, this is going to be my last drink, at least until I've done my day's work. So whenever I would take the first one, everything would center around, when am I going to get the next one? And yet, if you met me along the way in those days and you said, sister, who or what is the center of your life? I would have been insulted by the question. You just called me sister. You see how I'm dressed, every piece from stem to stern. You just saw me come out of that building called Convent, and you're asking me who's the center of my life. How come you don't know the center of my life is God? I would have been insulted by the question. Today, I choose to live honestly, thanks to you. And I have no problem in sharing with you. Somewhere along the line, the focus in my life shifted. And it shifted from God to that next drink. And I justified the use of alcohol in my life. I might say, too, because maybe someone needs to hear it. It was not one of my goals in life to become an alcoholic. I do not recall getting up a dark and gloomy day, a bright and sunny day, saying, today's the day, alky by six tonight. I'll destroy me and see how many I can take with me. I do not see alcoholism as self-inflicted. That's my opinion. I believe it is a sickness, disease, situation that comes to a person. I think it's a marvelous and wonderful idea that we have steps that suggest to us that in God's time we make amends because we are accountable. But I don't hold myself responsible for the sickness that came to me. However, I hold myself very, 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 very responsible for the precious life-giving gift of sobriety that has been given to me. I did not get sober. I tried to get sober. I couldn't pull it off. I don't believe a person can get sober. That's my opinion. I believe something bigger, greater, outside of the person takes place. They call it a miracle. And I believe the precious life-giving gift of sobriety is given. And I believe it's given by one bigger, greater than all of us put together. I choose to call that one God. So I feel very, very responsible to take care of the precious life-giving gift of sobriety that God has given me. So much so that I have no problem in sharing with you. If you should ever hear that Maurice is back drinking, please, please don't call me a victim. Call me a volunteer. And the very next thing you should say, somewhere along the line, she wasn't willing to do everything necessary to stay sober. I cannot plead ignorance today. You have taught me and taught me well how to take care of the precious life-giving gift of sobriety each day that God gives me. Going back to the scene in the bed with the eye in the pillow, the second thing I do each morning before I go looking for the eye, I pray the Lord's Prayer. And when I reach the part of the prayer that says, give us this day our daily bread, I emphasize the word daily because I want to remind myself, I will have sufficient bread, sufficient help for the day. He will not refuse anyone who asks for the bread for the help, but he gives it a day at a time. It is my responsibility then to take the bread, the help, and to use it to take care of the gift of sobriety for the rest of that day. There are advantages to years of sobriety. I've had them. But as the years of sobriety increase, so do the perils of smugness. Complacency is a killer. The little sheep that strays from the flock is usually the one that's found in the ditch, over the embankment, hanging from the barbed wire fence. A favorite fruit of mine is a banana. And every time I eat a banana, I have a meditation. And the meditation is, the banana that leaves the bunch is the one that gets skinned. I have a drunkologue that tells you quite well, all by myself, I can stay very sick and quite drunk. But I truly believe I cannot stay sober and fairly well without you. Well, how do you really know that, Maurice? You've never left us. When God was giving out ears, I thought he said beers. And I said two large ones. I'm an excellent listener to the sharing of other people. I was affected physically, mentally, spiritually, socially, emotionally from this disease. Physically, I fed out pretty well. There were times I tried to arrange my own physical death. I used to take the car, leave the Bronx, go across the George Washington Bridge, up the Palisades Parkway into Jersey, and I'd pull over where you could sightsee. And I'd say, when those cars are gone, when those folks are gone, I'm going to run this car over the embankment because I don't know what's the matter with me. And then I'd have what I call today a moment of amazing grace. And I'd say, I'll go get a drink. I'll come back and do this another time. So I was not to die physically, but there are other ways of dying. I'm sure you can identify. I suffered the death of my values. I suffered the death of my integrity. I suffered the death of everything I stood for as a woman, everything I stood for as a sister. All those areas of my life died. Outwardly, I looked pretty good, held a job, did it fairly well, tried to keep up with my responsibilities, and above all, I always said my prayers. No matter what condition I was in, I was always praying away. And some of you have shared with me that you thought you missed the boat because you didn't pray enough. Listen, I prayed enough for you and all belonging to you. So this disease must be so big that something as powerful as prayer will not take it away. I don't believe you can just pray your way through alcoholism. And yet we say, where would we be without prayer? Prayer is a path where there is none. But I think for folks like you and me, there's another piece that goes with the prayer. Pray and row the boat. And this beautiful way of life, this design for living, enables us to pray and to row the boat. I denied that alcohol was my problem. I was somewhat relieved when I learned that denial is the major presenting symptom of alcoholism. And when you're in denial, you're not in touch with reality. What I knew about my situation would fit on a postage stamp. What was happening in my life was as big as the state of California. But if I didn't have it up here when it was presented to me, then it didn't happen. Now, I had hundreds of people who talked to me about my drinking. Some of them wanted to be martyrs at an early age. The nerve of that one coming in here and talking to me about my drinking. And there were many times that I exercised the denial. My mother was in the hospital in New York City having a total hip operation. She was there for months and months and months. The operation wasn't as perfected then as it is today. Now I think they do it going up and down in the elevator. I went every day to be at my mother's bedside because that's where a good daughter should be. And one day my beautiful mother, beautiful Irish, soft-spoken lady, she said to me in a whisper, "If you don't come tomorrow, it'll be just fine. You must have a lot of work to do around the convent and the school. Why don't you skip a few days?" And I sat there thinking, way in here, wow, there she is with all her pain, and she's thinking of me. But I know today, because I'm in touch with reality, that my beautiful mother could not bring herself to say, "You're an embarrassment to me. You're no help to me. I don't need you around this hospital drunk." Now, I have one sister, and she's also a sister. I don't call her sister, but yet she's my sister. And during my active alcoholism, my sister secretly wished she joined a missionary community and lived in Mexico. It's very hard to be proud of a sick, untreated alcoholic. I know that today. I didn't know it then. My sister came to the hospital to visit my mother. She gave me one of those come outside the door kind of winks. I dutifully went outside. I figured she needs my advice, my help. My sister is very tall. And like my mother, she's a beautiful, soft-spoken lady. And in a whisper, she says to me, "Why? Why would you come to this hospital at 4 o'clock in the afternoon drinking?" I was just about to give her a lecture when it dawned on me. We've been down this road 100 times before. To the best of my recollection, not a word did I speak. But being a typical alcoholic, and that's all that I am, typical alcoholic, couldn't let well enough alone. So I took my right hand, the more powerful of my two, and I belted her. Shortly thereafter, two nurses came running down the hall and they are yelling, "Sisters, sisters." They were not calling us sisters because we were related by blood. But we were dressed like sisters used to dress. Some still dress today. My veil was on the floor. Hers was someplace else. Now, I learned a few years later that one of the major rules in this hospital, it's a very fine hospital, one of the major rules is that no patient leaves their room unescorted. They were coming out crutches, wheelchairs, all fours. Of course, the word got around there were two nuns out there killing one another. Now, in the midst of this chaos, I had a couple of thoughts. Interesting enough, I did not have the thought, maybe I shouldn't have belted her. I did not have the thought, maybe I shouldn't have had the last drink before I came down here. My major thought, as I'm looking up at my sister, is, why did she scream? That's how we got the hoop-de-doo. Well, you know, I look back today with a sober, clear head. Do you know it's perfectly normal? You belt someone, they let out a hoot. The other concern I had, my purse, had fallen onto the floor, making a rather loud sound as it fell to the floor. I was a little distracted with the purse. I wasn't too concerned about the few dollars in the purse. I have a vow of poverty. I kept it quite well during this time. But I was very concerned about the pint of holy water in the purse. One pint of Christian Brothers brandy. And what is the thinking of a sick, untreated alcoholic? No one leaves here with that purse other than you know who. Now, there's only one word to describe someone who'd be in that position. And I had to go through a lot of other descriptions before, with your help, I could get to what's proper, right, and fitting. And if there's anyone in this gathering who still sees themselves in this first grouping, I would suggest that you leave that thinking here because it does not apply. I had to go through bad, hopeless, weak-willed, sinner, you should know better. But the way I would describe someone today would be sick, unwell, not playing with full deck. That's respectful. Or I heard a fellow one night at a meeting, he described himself, he said he was a quart low. I heard another fellow another night, he said he had a photogenic mind. He just never had any film in the camera. Well, I had to go a ways before I see myself as sick and unwell. If you drink and you drive, you might miss the mark. I was always behind the wheel of a car. It was an insult to show on your face that you would drive us home. I brought you there, I'd bring you home. And you know, as sick and all as I was, there was one thing that I noted all the time in the moments like that. We'd all have a big to-do about the fact that I shouldn't be driving. I'd get in behind the wheel, and they'd all get in the car. My first accident, July of 1970. My dear friend, Sister Rose, was in court over the dismissal of a teacher in her school. She had a prominent lawyer, Rose did, appointed by the diocese. And I said, I'll be in court to help the lawyer help Rose. How do we affect the people on the other side of the coin? The night before the trial, Rose called me up and she said, Maurice, please don't come to court. My thinking, wow, there she is with all her pain and she's thinking of me. Well, I know today she was thinking of herself and rightly so. It was not my style to push. I said, you know what, Rose, you'll have a lot of paperwork to do. I'll go to my classes, I'll meet you downtown at lunchtime, you can brief me, and I'll advise you for the afternoon session. And to be rid of me, she said, fine. Well, I was in graduate school that summer, and I drove well-fortified from the top of the Bronx to the Wall Street section of my city. It was 5 minutes after 12 lunchtime, a working day in Wall Street, and the weather was clear. Those are the things they tell you at the top of the police report. It's important for our situation that we know the weather. A United States mail truck that was parked by the curb, minding its own business, got in my way. And I smashed into it. And when the policeman came on the driver's side, first word out of his mouth, you couldn't miss it. He said, sister. Now, I was a little taken back by the next part. He didn't say, sister, are you hurt? Could I call someone? Do you think women will ever be ordained? He said, sister, could you have been drinking? And for a moment, I wondered how the guy got on the police force. As was my style, officer, could I help you? I proceeded to tell the officer about my friend who was in court being persecuted, how upset I was, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, I went into a blackout, eventually a pass out. I woke up in a convent a short distance away. I woke up in a strange bed, half my clothes on, half my clothes off. I'm looking around. Where am I? What happened? I didn't have a clue. It was not my custom then, certainly not my custom today, to wake up in strange beds. Well, I'm around long enough to know that you have your story, but But at a time like that, we all have the same tricks of the trade. Where am I? What happened? And how do you get out of here? I could hear some talking through a partially open door, so I tiptoed over. I was glad the door was open a little bit, so I didn't have to squeak it. You know, we may be sick, but we're not stupid. We don't go over, throw the door open, and say, what the heck happened? You go over, you're glad the door's open a little bit because you hear voices. You put an eye out and an ear out to see if you could pick up a little something, because you know from previous experiences they will be questioning you and you don't know anything. So I go over, I get everything in place, and I see Rose. And I knew as long as Rose was there, everything was going to be fine. She had such nice things to say about me. She was always going around praying and, you know. Now, the other sister, neither of us knew the lady. She was at least 7 feet tall. She was like a lunatic. I got to the door as the big, tall sister is screaming at Rose. Your friend is on pills or she's drinking. In order to help her, you are going to have to hurt her. I thought that was poor advice. So I took the eye and the ear in. I went back to bed to get a little rest, to handle Rose, who came in and asked the going question in our lives at that time. What happened? I told it as I saw it. I lost control of the car because I was so upset about the court case. Now, in those days, the car was in my mother's name. My mother didn't know about the accident. I had the car fixed, back out on the road. 3 weeks had passed. Every time you talked to Rose, she had this question. When are we going to tell your mother about the accident? Never. Why do you want to tell my mother? Well, the car's in her name. So what? The car's fixed. Then the fears that set in for a sick, untreated alcoholic. What if Rose tells your mother? So I called Rose up, invited her out for supper, my treat. Took her to a little restaurant, leaned across the table in the restaurant and said, if you dare to tell my mother about the accident, someday you will come out of your convent, I'll be sitting in a car, and when you cross the street, that will be it. That is called threatening someone's life. Now, I always share that in my story, and one night, 100 years ago now, that means a long time, I was speaking someplace, and we had a friend at the meeting. She's not in program, but she came to hear me speak. And at the end, there was a little commotion, because she was trying to get up to me. So finally, she got up to me, and I said, what's the matter? She said, do you really think you would have run over Rose? Do you know, up to that moment, no one had ever asked me that question. Not even Rose. I thought for a moment and I said, of myself, no. I wouldn't hurt a fly. As a little tot, teenager, young adult, in the convent 100 years, that means a long time, you never knew I was around. I was always hiding out. What did I have to offer? I'm a nothing. I wouldn't harm you. You couldn't even see me. But, you know, you put one drink in here. The first one. And you can paint the most tragic scene you can think of. And I could be the one heading it up. It just wasn't to be part of my story. Or part of Rose's. That I would run her over. And I also like to point out, I've had people say to me over the years, you know, Maurice, like, you know, we know you're definitely an alcoholic, but you're a nun, you're a sister, you know, would you really kill some? I always like to point out, it wasn't that I was at Mass the next morning or that I was reading one of the 10,000 religious books that I had in those days. And the thought came to me, oh, you shouldn't kill Rose. No, that's not what happened for me. You know what happened? It was another moment of that amazing grace. And the other thing I like to point out, that after over 35 years of continuous sobriety, you put one drink in here, the first one, and you can paint the most tragic scene you can think of. And I could be the one heading it up. I don't know another disease situation like this one. How blessed are we to have been called into a way of life where we can keep that kind of a situation in check and get on and be that person that God wants us to be. How blessed are we to have beautiful Al-Anon, where you can come and take care of the effects of and get on and be that person that God wants you to be. However, if I fail to be grateful, I may lose the gift. And if I'm truly grateful, I will take care of the gift. Well, the situation was moving along, and one day I got a call from my boss. Now, in those days, if you got this kind of a personal call from the big boss, it was in the same category as the Pope called you up and said, get yourself over here to Rome. You never heard from the big boss. If she did call you personally, it was for either of two reasons. One, you were in trouble. Or there was a special assignment that only you could do. So I'm driving up to see the boss, and this is my thinking. I have enough to do. I get there and we have a little chit chat. She says, Maurice, I'll get to the point. Some of the sisters are saying that you drink too much. Now, in those days, you wouldn't dare ask a question of the big boss. I asked a question. I stuttered when I asked it. I said, well, where are they? And she got a little nervous because I guess no one ever asked her a question. And she said, oh, they don't want to be mentioned. And I said to myself, they feared for their lives. And, you know, in a very sick and negative way, I would not recommend this to anyone. I was into one of our steps at that moment. Made a list. Of all people who had harmed me. And asked God to be rid of them. Well, I asked her another question. I said, do you really know anything about me? Because in those days, there was a gap between the big boss and the rest of us. We had all these other bosses and other people in between. She said, well, I have a file. She went over and she peeked in. And she said, oh, I didn't know you were doing this in the diocese, and you're going to get your master's degree, and you just got this award. She closed the file. And she said, you know, Maurice, I will never, ever again believe this about any of our sisters. I said, that's a good policy to follow. She gave me an apology and off I went. And I walked back to the car and I had one thought. It was right here. She will never, ever, ever send for me again. She never did. Next time she arrived unannounced and put me away. So when I learned about denial, I like to keep things simple. Alcohol makes the alcoholic feel fine. Yada, yada, yoo. Therefore, he or she thinks everything is fine. Meanwhile, the people looking on are saying, oh, here we go again. When I learned that, it helped me immensely. I was angry and resentful during this time. Angry with God. I had given my life to God. What do you want from me? I love the word relationship. You've been my teachers about relationships. Prior to recovery, as a little tot, I put a game plan in place trying to relate to God. Now, I don't just come from an Irish Catholic family. My family has another dimension. We call it BIC. I come from a Bronx Irish Catholic family. Big difference. And they were always talking about going to heaven and going to hell and going to church and God's going to get you and the devil's watching you and you're bad and you'll never amount to any. So as a little tot, I said, I better find out about whoever this God is. So I made up a little game plan. And I continued the game plan all the way into the convent some years later. It went like this. I sat up straight. I knelt up straight. I disciplined myself. And, you know, we didn't have the expression in those days, but the expression that would have applied, been there, done that. And then when I was drinking, it was taking God on. Well, if you don't need me, I don't need you. And if I don't need someone bigger, greater outside of this lady here, I wonder who I think I am. So I was angry and resentful with God. I was depressed during this time. I was in the convent many years before I picked up alcohol. Didn't like taste of alcohol, didn't use alcohol. On the 5th of January, 1967, my beautiful father, Maurice, he went to God. And upon his death, when he looked eyeball to eyeball into the eyes of God, at that moment is perfection for anyone. And whatever you lack, you will receive at that moment. And that's how my father received sobriety. So he died of alcoholism at the age of 58. And I buried my father, and I went way inside. And shortly thereafter, I came out with a drink in my hand. And I can say quite comfortably today, my father and myself were carbon copies of one another with one big difference. The way we were to receive the precious life-giving gift of sobriety. So I was using alcohol to lift me out of a depression, I was getting more depressed. The bargaining stage, one bargain I like to share on. I got into bed one night, always had my rosary beads, prayer beads, praying away, hanging on to the sheets with the other hand. I'm no sooner in the bed and I have to get up and get a drink. And I said to God, you know what? I don't want to drink anymore tonight. Please help me. I'll do more work for you and for your people. Please don't let me drink anymore tonight. Well, see, the first drink of the day always has the final say. And, of course, we had had that. So the covers get pushed back and the prayer beads go to the floor and you get up out of the bed and you crawl along in the dark and you find your hiding spot and you get your bottle and you do something you don't want to do. You take another drink. And after I took that drink that night, I beat that floor and I doubted the existence of God. How could a God who loved me, a God I'm to relate to, how could you allow me to be in that condition? I'll bet there's no God. I live in downtown Manhattan, right in the heart of New York City. Now, when I'm in town, I drive on the FDR Drive, the East River Drive, and I see our brothers and sisters, yours and mine. They're on both sides of the highway there. They build their homes there out of cardboard boxes, and you see them frying an egg, and they need a pair of shoes, and they have little brown bags. I only had one kind of brown bag. They have my kind and other kinds. And those folks, our brothers and sisters, if they went over to the guardrail and they beat the guardrail and they doubted the existence of God, we'd say, poor socks. What have they got going for them? I'm in a beautiful convent at the time. I want for nothing. And alcohol brought me to the point where I doubted the existence of God. As we say in here, whether you come from Yale or jail, Park Avenue, Park Bench, what does it matter where you came from? I think it's important to get to know your history, your story, but I put more energy into where do we go from here? Whatever happened this morning, yesterday, a week ago, a year ago, or 100 years ago, you have taught me to learn from the experience, but not to let it stand in the way of putting one foot in front of the other and being that person that God created you to be. And the other thing I did that night, I cried out at the top of my lungs, isn't there anybody, anywhere, who knows what I'm going through? Because each one in the throes of the sickness thinks nobody knows what I'm going through. Well, I didn't know you were up the street and around the corner and over the hill and down the mountain and across the highway going through the same thing, but I'm mighty glad that somewhere along the line God saw fit that we would find one another in this beautiful fellowship. And it is God who has arranged our meeting. I truly believe that. C.S. Lewis, you've heard of him. He says in one of his writings about relationships, he talks about relationships in general. And he says it's as if God says to the people in the relationship, you have not chosen one another, but I, God, have chosen you for one another. If you think of the relationships that you have in the fellowship, would you of yourself have chosen those people? Maybe yes, maybe no. I like to think it was arranged, like happened at the Gatehouse in Akron, Ohio, some time back with Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob. And do you know, as a result of that arranged relationship, here we are this afternoon? It's really fascinating when you put it out there and reflect on it. Well, today I make bargains, deals, promises, commitments, and I follow through. I attribute that to one fact and one fact only. I don't drink alcohol while I'm sober. Very significant to Maurice's life. And the final stage is acceptance. The disease was moving along, and finally it all came to a head because I had two exceptional do-gooders in my life. My sister and Rose. And keeping it very simple, they snitched. They blew the whistle and turned me into the boss that I had charmed a few months before. They brought the boss to my mother's where I was hiding out. I noticed a marked difference in the boss. She wasn't interested in anything I had to say. And she was talking past tense. She was saying things like, arrangements have been made. And they're expecting you in Lutheran General Hospital in Park Ridge, Illinois. I listened. She said you could go Friday or Saturday. I listened. Then she said, there you will find out what is wrong with you. And all of a sudden, way in here, I said to myself, there isn't anything wrong with me. And then she said, you'll be there for 28 days. And way in here, I said, I won't be there for 28 minutes. But as sick at all as we are not stupid. And I knew the only way I was going to get out of the room was to say to her, I'll go. I said, I'll go Saturday. Now, you want to know about the people on the other side of the coin? My sister jumps up and says, she'll never go. She hates to fly. Oh, I said, I'll go. So I went out on an AA plane, American Airlines, the way I like to go. And I met 64 charming men and women like you. And the word got around quickly that we had this Catholic sister, this nun in treatment. One by one, they came to me, the patients. They beat up on themselves. They said terrible things about themselves. But they always finished by saying, you know, sister, this is a mistake for you. You're not like me. You shouldn't be in a place like this. Well, believe you me, anyone who thinks like I do, they're going to be my friend. I had a nifty getaway plan, and I scrapped it. I'm not one who sits around idle. Do you know by the end of the first week, I was a therapist. And the word got around quickly. You don't like your counselor, you don't like your group, you don't like the meetings, talk to the sister. She knows everything about everything. Now, every day at 1 o'clock, we had what they call free time. Well, you know, remember those 28-day programs they put, you know, tell you what to do at 1 o'clock, free time, and then under it, this is what you'll do with it, you know. I always did as I was told. So we were supposed to be in our rooms at 1 o'clock. We had a nice table, tape recorder, pens, books. I'd block out what happened yesterday. I'm going to do these assignments. I'd be there 2 minutes each day, and I take the table and everything on it, and I throw it clear across the room, and I go to the wall behind me, banging my head against the wall, yelling and screaming at God, why me? I've been so good. I've been so good. This is what you've done to me. My roommate had run out. She'd say, she's at it again. There'd be blood pouring out of my head. They'd come in, clean me up, calm me down. I'd be fine till the next day at 1 o'clock. I was too sick then, and long before that time, to hear God say, you don't have to be good. You are good. That's a given. No one has been deprived of that goodness. No one. But where does the bad come in? Oh, it's there. Attitude, behavior. I try, key word try, to separate attitude and behavior from the person. I try, key word try, to separate attitude and behavior from this lady here. And I continue to chip away at my attitude and my behavior through that marvelous and wonderful process of recovery. And I do it along with folks like you. And while the process continues, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly, I walk very tall. I cannot help but be impressed at the goodness and holiness that sits and stands in this room. And if you're not there yet, borrow from me till you get your own strength. I don't know of another outfit in society that mentions the word spirituality or the word spiritual more than folks like you and me. You want to know the key to a life-giving, healthy spirituality for anyone? It's getting in touch with your own goodness. And the world has missed the boat with that. How blessed are we to have been called into a way of life where you can chip away at your stuff through a beautiful process of recovery. And you do it along with other folks. And little by slowly, perhaps, you get in touch with the marvelousness and the wonderfulness and the goodness. You don't have to be good. You are good. Well, some 35 years later, and for quite a while now, I have a why me question of God. Not why me, why am I an alcoholic? But why me, God? Tell me again. Why am I sober, since most people don't receive this gift? And it's a frequent question of mine. And the reason I ask it, I do not want to take sobriety for granted. I don't want my attitude to be big deal, sober, 35 years, old timer, long time, whatever. I want to stay in touch with the gift. So I have this little game plan. And I say to God, tell me again, God, why am I sober? Since most people don't receive this gift. And he answers the same way all the time. And he says, Maurice, you have not chosen me, but I have chosen you. The big book says God did for him what he could not do for himself. And he says, many are called to the disease of alcoholism. Many are called to the situation on the other side of the coin. Very few, a drop in the bucket, are chosen for the precious life-giving gift of sobriety, the precious life-giving gift of recovery in Al-Anon. And I say, well, why me, God? He says, well, make your little chart. I make a little chart. I headed alcoholism. I put a simple line down the center. I put on this side of the chart, all of us in recovery. Round the world, AA, Al-Anon combined, fairly big number. You put on this side of the chart all those who are still out there. You wouldn't even see us. I find it awesome to be on that side of the chart. And I don't want to take it for granted, so I do the why me. Okay, God, why am I on that side of the chart? He says, Maurice, how do you see death? 100 years ago now, that means a long time, I sat with death. What is death all about? What is God doing? I was just reading and listening to tapes, meditating on death. And I read a line that I had read many times before. But this time I had a moment of amazing grace. And the line is, there's a time to be born. And there's a time to die. And that's on God's calendar. And I believe any person goes to God in death when their work here on earth is finished. I do not see the God of my understanding as a yo-yo. Well, I'm taking out one and I'm leaving those three and that one's going to get... No, I see the God of my understanding this way, 24 hours a day. But your work is finished. I may have more work for that person to do. But on God's calendar, their work is finished. And the other thing that helps me, I'll see those people again when my work is finished. Well, the point, untreated alcoholism is still listed as an ultimate terminal condition, 100% fatal. And here we are. Well, I believe our death has been interrupted because our work is not finished. There'll be tragedy in our world tonight. Some people will go to God, their work is finished. Others will be saved, their work is not finished. Those who are saved, I don't know what their work is. More will be revealed to them. I believe ours is defined. It's a specialized work. And nobody does it as well as the people in the rooms. With all due respect to the church, the medical profession, other forms of help, they do a lot for people like you and me. But you know what? There's just something about one member of AA sharing with another member of AA. Like happened at the Gatehouse some time back with Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob. You know what? There's just something about one member of Al-Anon sharing with another member of Al-Anon. Specialized work. And nobody does it as well as the people in the rooms. With all due respect to the church, the medical profession, other forms of help. They do a lot. But there's just something about one alcoholic sharing with another, one member of Al-Anon sharing with another. So my major assignment on any given day, and I take the liberty of saying, I believe yours is the exact same as mine. To take care of the gift of sobriety, the gift of recovery in Al-Anon, to carry a message, to walk with, to pass it on, to be the fellowship. That's my major assignment on any given day. What else does he want us to do? You get notified as you go along. There are many ways to carry a message. Pontificating at the podium is one way to carry a message. As soon as David made that first call, and then we came here and met so many people. When we got off the plane, I'm very farsighted. I couldn't even see the sign that Kathy had. But I saw Kathy, and she wasn't even saying a word. So many ways to carry a message. That's why we're called a program of attraction rather than promotion. People just see it. Well, very late in the fourth week, I came to grips with this. Not the way I see it today. But I woke up on the 27th and a half day of the 28-day program, and there was something different about me. I was crying and laughing and shouting, I'm really an alcoholic. Because up to that moment, I had been mouthing it. And I went to see my one-on-one counselor at the facility, a beautiful Lutheran minister. We had many one-on-one sessions together. And I said to him, Reverend, I'm really an alcoholic. And this man, he did something that he never did in any of the sessions. He started dancing around the room. And he got so excited. And he said, I have a prescription for you to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you're faithful to the prescription, you will only have to return here as our guest. I said, I won't make you any promises, but I'll see what I can do. And by that amazing grace of God, as it operates in rooms like this, and my cooperation with the grace. Another way of saying that. We know the program works. But if you don't work the program, it doesn't work for you. So by my doing my part. I haven't found it necessary to pick up a drink or any substitute since April 17, 1971. I am not one who says I will never drink again. If I thought I would never drink again, perhaps I wouldn't be as faithful. Early this morning, I asked for daily bread. We'll see how tomorrow goes. So I came into these rooms, and I did the old one, too. I didn't drink. I went to meetings. Went to meetings, didn't drink. Could always be found sitting in the third row waiting for this thing to be finished. But they weren't going to say I wasn't there. One night, I heard a fellow share, and this is what he said. He said he learned unless he put the 12 suggested steps into his life and made some changes, he could very well lose his sobriety. And I sat up real tall, put a little smirk on my face, because I was sure he was going to say, "We don't mean that for the little sister there in the third row." "And with your help, I learned why I was so miserable. All I heard you say, change or die." I used to poke the one next to me and say, "Isn't there something in between?" "No, there isn't anything in between. No, if you're an alcoholic, if you're a member of Al-Anon, you're always in motion. You're changing or you're dying. You're getting weller or you're going back. But no big deal. Don't make a big deal of it. We have a beautiful process. Marvelous and wonderful folks to walk with us. And my responsibility before God, I'll try. God blesses effort." So little by slowly, change started to happen and continues to happen up to this moment, because I continue to be a student of the principles and traditions, and I do it along with folks like you. And the three changes that started to happen, I have them in three categories. The first had to do with the intellect. When I came to you, I had thinking that went, "Ready, fire, aim." I had postage stamp thinking. It was my way or no way. And we talked about that. And you said, "Maurice, you know, work your steps to the best of your ability. Don't go it alone. It'll do wonders for your head." And I've had what I call up here an intellectual conversion. Then the moral conversion. I lost my value system. That bothered me terribly. And you said, "Maurice, work your steps to the best of your ability. Don't go it alone. And you'll be able to put first things first and second things second. And when you're wrong, you'll be able to promptly admit it. You'll be able to practice the principles in all your affairs. And you'll even be able to practice the principles and you won't have affairs." And I took your suggestion and I got my value system back, and I've had what I call a moral conversion. And then the third one was the spiritual. You were always talking about spirituality, spiritual program. And I used to say to myself, because I was very shy at that time, I still am today. I used to say, "Well, this spiritual sounds interesting, but see, I have religion." Do you know, when I came to a meeting for much of my first year, I could not walk straight into the room. I had to go in sideways because I had flags in my ears. Catholic, Catholic, very, very Catholic. So I had to go in sideways. And we talked about that one day. And you said to me, "You know, Maurice, our program teaches us balance. And you helped me to get centered with my religion." You also gave me a marvelous and wonderful technique. I use it in many areas, one of which is my religion. I take what helps me, and I leave the rest. And I'm comfortable. So I said, "Well, okay, tell me about this spirituality." And you said to me, "It has to do with relationships." "Oh," I said, "I didn't know that." And you said, "Yeah, relating to a higher power." You know, I said, "Oh, I got to get that squared away." You said, "It also has to do with relating to others." "Oh, my relationships were a mess." And you said, "It also has to do with relating to yourself." And I said, "I'll never have spirituality. There's nothing here to relate to." And you said, "We'll help you get in touch." And you have taught me the full meaning of love your neighbor as yourself. You have taught me to thine own self be true. You have taught me, if it is virtue to love your neighbor, it must be virtue and not a vice to love yourself. And little by slowly, as I chipped away at my stuff through the 12 suggested steps and had people like you walking with me, I got in touch with the marvelousness and the wonderfulness that was in there that I thought I was deprived of. So I've had what I call a spiritual conversion. So when God gives the gift of sobriety, the gift of recovery in Al-Anon, I believe he says three things. One, I'm interrupting your death because your work's not finished. Carry a message, walk with, pass it on, be the fellowship.
Me yesterday, how I felt being the final speaker with all the marvelous and wonderful speakers we've had. And once in a while I'm asked that, and I was reminded of when I was a senior in high school a few years back. And on Friday, the last class of the day, this priest came. He was the final class at the end of the week on Friday. And he would come in and he would say to the senior class, "They saved the good wine till last." Of course, his name was Monsignor Goodwine. I close with a short version of Maurice's story. Sometime they'll invite me for the short version. Well, I'll go anyway. I'm sure you can identify with it. Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now I'm found. Was blind, but now I see. And may God, however you understand that God, may God bless you and God bless me and God keep you and God keep me, because nobody does it quite as well. Thank you so very much.